Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Come On Get Happy, The Making of Summerstock by David Fantle and Tom Johnson. Foreword by Savion Glover. Narrated by Paul Bamer. I'd like to say one word about the people the public has never seen who knocked themselves out so we could look good. No one knows their names. They made us strive to do better things. Gene Kelly, American Film Institute Life Achievement Award, 1985. Foreword, Savion Glover. I'm so glad the authors turned me on to this jewel of a film, Summerstock. At the same time, I was disappointed to know that until I first saw it a few months ago, I wasn't aware of it. I started dancing on Broadway back in 1984 as the titular tap dance kid. I was 11 years old then, and a chorus line was playing in the theater right next door. Of course, I had heard Singin' in the Rain, Stormy Weather with the great Bojangles, and the soaring Nicholas Brothers, who I came to know personally. And I remembered Gene Kelly dancing with Jerry the Mouse. But Summerstock? Wow! The musical is one of those great vintage movies that follows all the rules, has all the ingredients that define a hit, a masterpiece. Great story, memorable music, star power with Judy Garland and Gene in the leads, hilarious secondary characters, and more. I got to know Fred Kelly, Gene's brother, when I was hanging out with Gregory Hines and Honey Coles back in the day. I was still being taught tap by Honey and Gregory. Lon Chaney, the dancer, not the actor, and Jimmy Slide, and the other great black hoofers, but I remember Fred and Gregory arguing good-naturedly about the origin of tap dancing. Fred said tapping stemmed from Irish clogging, and Gregory said that it was born from African-American dancing and rhythms. They didn't agree, but it was a friendly disagreement. I was young, so I just listened and absorbed. And that's just it. We are all part of that ongoing tradition. We learn and absorb from who came before us. I know that Gene, when he was working on Broadway in the late 1930s, would visit Harlem and the Cotton Club, Small's Paradise, and the Apollo Theater to learn, study, steal, and that he must have loved every minute of it. All these great artists, Gene Kelly, Sammy Davis Jr., Steven Spielberg, whoever they are, deliver the goods. And then it's up to us not to change it exactly, but rather to explore what they were doing and put our own stamp on it, absorb it, and then pass that legacy on. When you examine the numbers themselves, dig, 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 dig for your dinner, the challenge dance in the barn with that wonderful frisson between Judy and Gene, the newspaper dance, and Judy's Get Happy, they are so advanced, rhythmic, syncopated. I listened intently to what was being put down on the floor and dug all of them. I realized how groovy those numbers were and, therefore, how groovy and timeless they still are. And to capture it all on film? Amazing. And I want to say something about Eddie Bracken, who plays Orville Wingate, Judy's fiancé in the film. He's fantastically funny, and the whole emotional blackmail thing he does, holding the tractor he gifted Judy over her head, really resonated with me. It's a kind of bondage she was being held in that is topical to any era in history. Another thing about all that connectedness. Nick Castle helped Gene out with the dances on Summerstock. He also helped the Nicholas Brothers on Stormy Weather and other films they did. Decades later, his son, Nick Castle Jr., wrote and directed the movie Tap, which I appeared in, along with Gregory and Sammy. Again, that legacy. David and Tom, in their own way, are following that tradition, adding to the legacy by chronicling how Summerstock got made and the afterlife as such that it had. I think that you'll appreciate the movie even more after you've listened to their book. Savion Glover is a Tony Award-winning choreographer and dancer. Introduction. Why Summerstock? That's the question, greeted with raised eyebrows or even greater degrees of incredulity, we received from many people, directors, actors, musicologists, even hardcore fans of the genre, when we told them we were writing a book about the making of this 1950 Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios Technicolor musical, a movie many felt was a bit old-fashioned even upon its release more than 70 years ago. In fact, no less a legend than Broadway producer-slash-director Hal Prince, in an email to us not long before he died in 2019, questioned our choice of Summerstock as the subject for a book. We had reached out for comments to Prince's wife, Judy, the daughter of Saul Chaplin, who served as a music director and composer on Summerstock. "I saw Summerstock, and I'm fascinated that you should want it as a centerpiece in your book," Prince wrote. Obviously, or perhaps obviously for us, Get Happy was essentially an appendage to that film, and in every respect, a brilliant one. Saul's work was consummate. Judy Garland looked glorious, and the staging looked perfect. It's a sort of schizoid project, is it not? Admittedly, Summerstock is not in the same league as other MGM musicals from the storied studio's heyday. Meet Me in St. Louis, 1944. Easter Parade, 1948. An American in Paris, 1951. Singin' in the Rain, 1952, The Bandwagon, 1953, and Gigi, 1958, all produced by the studio's preeminent producer of musicals, Arthur Freed. Summerstock was produced by Joe Pasternak, a jovial Hungarian immigrant who gifted the world some musical trifles starring Deanna Durbin, a few Mario Lanza operatic confections, and who rarely made a movie where the end credits didn't scroll without a feel-good conclusion having just played out. Nonetheless, we've always felt Summerstock has been unduly unheralded, slighted with that vague and dismissive moniker of being, perhaps, underrated. And that, taking into account Summerstock's stellar cast, clocking in with brilliant performances and the sheer joie de vivre on display throughout the film, is a gross disservice, especially considering the troubled atmosphere surrounding the movie. The backstory of how this film, starring Judy Garland and Gene Kelly, in their third and final pairing, was brought to the screen, contains enough drama, heartache, and genuine selflessness to fuel the plots of a score of MGM melodramas. It took a Herculean effort and the bottomless empathy of Kelly, co-stars Phil Silvers, Eddie Bracken, Carlton Carpenter, and director Charles Walters to pull a performance out of a drug-addled and emotionally spent Garland, who was the locus of some production delays, and made completing the fraught project one that defied the odds makers. Judy had, from a very early age, become addicted to prescription medication, and throughout her life, various friends had enabled that dependency by making drugs readily available to her, a boost she felt she needed to get through long production days where she had to be perfect. For Garland, the desire to appear on camera only when she felt she was at her best had been accepted as the price that must be paid, gladly, for her brilliance. Kelly, and especially Judy, were used to working on freed time, which boiled down to getting it right and making it better, no matter how long it took. A legacy from Arthur Freed, the paternalistic producer who oversaw most of Gene's and Judy's movies. Conversely, Pasternak was used to wrapping up productions on a schedule you could clock with an egg timer. However, never before had Pasternak been privy to the array of musical talent that he landed for Summerstock. Two major stars who, with Fred Astaire, were the premier musical talent at the studio, and a director in Walters who had worked with them all and who had an innate flair for the genre. Looming over all of this was MGM production chief Dorie Sherry, never a big fan of musicals, who had little patience for the largesse granted to creatives accustomed to invoking the artistic muse, especially if it affected the financial bottom line. Sherry's filmmaking credo was to churn 'em out in 6 to 8 weeks, the sooner the better. It has become gospel in almost every book that references Summerstock to charge Garland as the sole reason for the delays that affected the film's production schedule. Come On, Get Happy, The Making of Summerstock, will dispel that commonly held myth, as well as others. In fact, there were many production delays that far superseded Garland's absences from the set, including the time needed to write, arrange, record, and film new songs that were added late in the production, and the shooting of two solo numbers for Garland and Kelly that occurred weeks after the film had officially wrapped. Although getting Summerstock to the screen was not always a get-happy experience for the principals involved, the backstory reveals strong camaraderie with practical jokes. Bracken was a chief instigator, and set visits from Garland's and Gloria DeHaven's children that underscored the deep friendships the cast shared with each other and that helped them weather the rough spots during shooting. On the face of it, the movie is pure Joe Pasternak, a cheery, gemütlich affair with the kind of simple plot that wouldn't overly tax the gray matter of audiences, much less the screenwriters who concocted it. A troupe of uppity New York City actors invade a Connecticut farmstead to stage their show, which they hope is destined for Broadway. For Garland and Kelly, Summerstock seemed like a backward step in their respective career trajectories, particularly for Garland, who couldn't help but have a sense of déjà vu that the story of putting on a show in a barn was a throwback to the kinds of movies in which she and Mickey Rooney had starred throughout the late 1930s and early 1940s. In 1949, when Summerstock was being shot on Stage 27, Judy's star was falling, not with her legion of adoring fans, but with the hierarchy at MGM, the only studio she had ever known, while Jean's was on the ascent. Kelly was fresh off On the Town, 1949, a landmark musical that featured several scenes filmed on location in New York City, and he was just months away from beginning work on An American in Paris, which would win 6 Academy Awards in 1951, a record at the time for a musical, including the Oscar for Best Picture and a special award for Kelly's choreography. 7 years earlier, in 1942, it was Garland, MGM's golden child, who mentored Kelly in For Me and My Gal, his first movie. But in 1949, their roles had reversed, and it was Kelly who provided emotional support to Garland in a film that both he and director Charles Walters considered an outdated relic from the Andy Hardy era of teenage opuses. After 14 years and more than 24 films, 80 singles for Decca, several hundred radio shows, World War II bond and servicemen shows, an abortion, two failed marriages, being a more or less single mother to a 3-year-old child and a less than satisfactory husband in Vincent Minnelli, Garland's life was cratering. She was 27. Summerstock would be Judy's final movie at MGM before the studio terminated her contract. Maybe Hal Prince was right with his schizoid comment. And yet, despite the Greek tragedy that played out sometimes daily, thankfully offstage when the cameras weren't rolling, Summerstock is a film packed with musical gems, including two of the best solo numbers that Kelly and Garland ever performed, as well as a duet, a challenge tap dance in the barn, chock full of nuance that's the very definition of chutzpah. Brian Siebert, dance critic of the New York Times, in his authoritative history, What the Eye Hears, A History of Dancing, which was a finalist for a National Book Critics Circle Award in 2015, regards Summerstock as Kelly's finest tap dancing on film. In Siebert's estimation, Kelly's solo in an empty barn, incorporating a squeaky board and an abandoned newspaper into his routine, becomes an improvisational tour de force worthy of comparison to Fred Astaire's best solo numbers. As he plays with the board's squeak and the paper's swish and rip, Siebert writes, the predictable rhythms build in waves. The ending is just right. The way he halves and quarters the newspaper with his feet, gets interested in a headline, walks off absorbed in his reading, and happens upon the errant board for one final creak. Performed to composer Harry Warren's You Wonderful You, the number was Kelly's personal favorite of all his solo film dances. He preferred it even over his iconic title number from Singin' in the Rain. The movie climaxes with Garland belting out Get Happy, a Harold Arlen, Ted Kohler, blues-tinged rouser dating back to 1930 that had been interpolated into the score, much to Warren's chagrin. The song, aptly described by Hal Prince as an appendage, was filmed weeks after production on Summerstock had wrapped and was a latecomer, a kind of Hail Mary that Walters thought was needed to inject more pizzazz into the movie and shore up Garland's performance with her very own showstopper. The number, with Garland looking svelte, she had been zoftig throughout the film and had lost weight in the interim, and chicly decked out in a shortened tuxedo jacket, black slouch fedora, and black nylons, is a syncopated jam. Backed up by a cadre of hand-clapping eccentric male dancers, also dressed in black, Garland struts, flourishes, and shouts like she's just been infused with the Holy Ghost at a big tent evangelist revival meeting somewhere south of the Mason-Dixon line. The staging and her singing are electric, and the song remains at the very top of the Garland canon, along with Over the Rainbow and The Man That Got Away. Get Happy turned out to be the final number Garland filmed at her alma mater, and what a finish it is. In addition to the stellar songs and dances, Summerstock features a veteran troika, expert in milking laughs. Phil Silvers, who had provided Wiseacre comic relief 6 years earlier in Covergirl, 1944, with Kelly, does the same in Summerstock. His snarky delivery foretells a breakout television role in 1955 as the conniving Sergeant Bilko in You'll Never Get Rich. A stalwart of Preston Sturges's screwball comedy stock company, Eddie Bracken, The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, Hail the Conquering Hero, both released in 1944, killed at playing milquetoasts and nerds throughout his career, just as he does here. Comically nearsighted, an effect exaggerated by his round eyeglasses, which, when allied to his pronounced proboscis, made him look like a spooked owl, and with a chin so weak it seemed at times to recede in his jaw, Bracken was a natural laugh-getter who constantly reduced Garland to convulsions on the Summerstock set. Rounding out the film's comic foils is Marjorie Main, playing the role of Garland's housekeeper, Esme, with the same crusty impudence that made her Ma Kettle character a hit with audiences, and might have saved Universal Studios from bankruptcy, over the course of 10 Ma and Pa Kettle movies. In 1985, when Kelly accepted the American Film Institute's Life Achievement Award, he pointed to the screen behind him and told the audience, "That's what you do up there. You dance love, and you dance joy, and you dance dreams." He might just as well have been speaking of his screen partnership with Garland. Each brought out in the other tenderness, vulnerability, and joyous chemistry that they seldom shared with any other co-star. The affection Kelly and Garland had for each other is palpable, stretching back to For Me and My Gal. Perhaps because Summerstock was mired in problems that cropped up each day, that solicitation, love, between them is very much on display, especially in the movie's later scenes when grudging attraction between their characters gives way to love itself. Garland was a brilliant, natural actor, but even she didn't need to feign the feelings that make those scenes so heartfelt. Perhaps more than anything, Summerstock is a maddening dichotomy. A movie freighted with problems throughout the shooting schedule, even before principal photography commenced, and that loomed ever larger and extended even beyond Garland's absences and erratic behavior, which became more pronounced as time went on. Still, ironically, despite the pain it took to complete the film, Summerstock fulfilled Pasternak's credo of a happy ending. Cinematically, at least. What's more, it's a tribute to the professionalism of both cast and crew that none of the Sturm und Drang that informed making the movie appears on screen. And in that, Summerstock exemplifies just how movie-making was accomplished in the studio system era when every problem begged a solution and failure wasn't an option. During our research, which involved consulting numerous archives, internet, print, and microfiche, that any project like this understandably entails, we also tried to do something we believe is a tad novel. We buttonholed numerous contemporary dancers, singers, choreographers, musicians, and even Garland impersonators to get their take on Summerstock, its stars, and any enduring legacy they think the film might have. We were pleasantly surprised at the enthusiasm many of these artists showed in wanting to contribute to our book. As college journalists working on the Minnesota Daily, the University of Minnesota's student paper, we traveled to Los Angeles in the late 1970s and early 1980s to conduct sit-down interviews with Gene Kelly, Charles Walters, and the principal composer of the score for Summer Stock, Harry Warren. At each meeting, we asked wide-ranging questions about their careers, including several pointed queries about Summer Stock. But we had little idea then that some 40 years later we'd write a book on the making of the film. Perhaps it took that amount of time for the idea to fully gestate into determined action. That, and the creeping realization that the movie has often been overlooked, even by movie musical fans. Come On, Get Happy, The Making of Summer Stock, is our effort to remedy some of that short-sightedness and possibly encourage new viewers, as well as casual fans of the film, to fully embrace its many merits and, in doing so, elevate the movie into the praiseworthy centerpiece, as Hal Prince would quizzically have it, that it truly deserves to be. Chapter 1. The Studio. MGM, Dream Factory in Transition. Slated as production number 1477, Summer Stock began rehearsals at MGM on Stage 27 in October 1949. World War II had ended 4 years previously, and America was riding high as the world's first burgeoning superpower, one whose homeland and industry were untouched by the cataclysm that had devastated Europe and much of Asia. To many Americans, and especially the contract stars and the army of rank-and-file studio workers that enabled the major Hollywood studios to churn out hundreds of films each year, the expectation was that, with the economy booming and prosperity entrenched, the future held no limits on what the industry could achieve in the way of riches. But signs foretelling a different, more ominous scenario for the movie industry as a whole, and MGM in particular, were looming on the horizon. And the nadir of the studio system that had prevailed since the 1920s would come sooner and land harder than anyone could have imagined. On February 10th, 1949, 9 months before Summer Stock went before the cameras, and a year to the month before principal photography wrapped, pugnacious MGM studio chief Louis B. Mayer, the human personification of the studio's mascot, Leo the Lion, put on his best game face and presided over a star-studded luncheon to commemorate the studio's silver anniversary. The cavernous 23,000-square-foot Stage 29 was converted to a dining hall, and the luncheon climaxed MGM's 25th anniversary sales convention. Film reel footage of the studio's famous roster of contract players, mostly seated in alphabetical order, captured Fred Astaire chatting with Judy Garland, Clark Gable cracking up Ava Gardner in between drags on their cigarettes, and Buster Keaton playing to the camera with the crudités. A real case of celery shtick. In his remarks, Mayer cautioned the assembly about competitive pressures confronting the industry. "We have to economize today because of changing conditions," Mayer said, and then seemed to contradict himself when he added, "but to concentrate on cheaper pictures at a loss of quality will never solve the problems of the film industry." The biggest competitive pressure to which Mayer alluded was a gadget that was gaining ground and beginning to strike fear into the hearts of studio heads and movie exhibitors alike. Just the year before, in June 1948, Milton Berle had entered the newfangled world of television, and Tuesday nights would never be the same again. He became, literally, an overnight sensation, and his Texaco
Sample complete. Ready to continue?